Now, Hebrews 13:17 says that elders will give an blank for the souls of those in their care. They will give an account. Very good. True or false? Elders have the responsibility of guarding the congregation against various internal and external threats. Think about that for a minute. Is all of that true? And the answer is true, because the threats can be from outside the church in the form of people trying to get us to believe false things or trying to pull people away into the world, friends and neighbors trying to influence us in the wrong way. Or it could be from inside the church. In fact, it could be from inside the eldership. Remember in Acts chapter 28, when Paul said, "Take heed unto yourselves and unto the flock," in that paragraph he said that grievous wolves will arise from among your own selves. And so even from among their own selves. So, and actually, that's how the major digression from the truth got started, was from one elder wanting to be the bishop or the head elder. And of course, we know from the Bible that all the elders are bishops. But historically, the big falling away from the faith came when the organizational structure of the church got convoluted and one elder tried to take the rule over the other elders. Okay? So that's a very good answer there. True. Nope. Number four. True or false? The word sober in 1 Timothy 3:2 refers exclusively to not being drunk. Think about that for a minute. And the answer is false. It's a bigger qualification. Would it include not being drunk with wine or beer? Yes, but it has a bigger meaning, which involves being able to think soberly about a range of issues. Very good. Next question. True or false? Members of the congregation always are aware of every factor that goes into elders' decisions. And the answer is false. Sometimes there are things that the members don't need to know. And it's just the elders have to use their discretion about how much to tell the congregation in some cases, because it would hurt the church if some things got out. It would hurt people's feelings. It would be bad for the church if every factor was known. And sometimes the elders are able to let us know more than they can let us know at other times. But we need to be cautious before we're overly critical of elders, given that we may not know all of the factors. We may not understand everything that goes into a decision, and maybe we don't need to know. Okay, now tonight our two qualifications are respectable in the ESV, or of good behavior in the King James Version, or orderly in the American Standard Version, and the second one has to do with hospitality. Is he hospitable or is he given to hospitality? I think those are the two main translations of that word. Okay, so let's talk about the first one, this of good behavior, or orderly, or respectable. It literally pertains to having characteristics or qualities that evoke admiration or delight. This has to do something with his personality. This has to do with how well he's able to get along with people. This has to do with what do people think about when they think of him? Do they think of him as somebody who behaves well? Or does he cause problems? We'll see some of that qualification here. It's used of respectable and honorable persons. And BADG there is an abbreviation for one of the main Greek lexicons that gives you the definitions of Greek words. It's a Greek dictionary, a dictionary of New Testament words. And it stands for the editors. Bauer, Arndt is one of them, a Danker, and what does the G stand for? I can't remember what the G stands for, but those are the editors. So if you ever see BADG, that's a lexicon. Like Thayer is a lexicon. He's one of the others. Thayer is a man who edited a lexicon of Greek words. A lexicon is just a dictionary. So your dictionary on your shelf, your English dictionary, could be called a lexicon. So I usually will give you a definition from one of these main lexicons, and then I will put the name of the author in the parentheses, just so you know where I'm coming from. But I'm giving you respectable, well-known, standard lexicons and not some random person. So don't worry about that. Just know that we're talking about real people who know the language. Okay. Now the next one I got there is, it means, of this word translated of good behavior, means well-arranged, seemly, modest, and describes a man living with decorum. So this is a wide-ranging word that has to do with, does he behave himself well in a respectable and honorable way? I think you're seeing what the meaning was. It means or refers to having a love for good rules. A love for good rules. That's an interesting thing too, because somebody who's unruly is always trying to push the envelope, is always trying to do something that is against the rules. And some people are like that. I've heard of people who are, what is the right word? They always are looking for a thrill, maybe. This may be applying to younger people, but for example, some people grow up this way where they're always trying to, maybe they always want to speed a lot and they always want to do stunts. And you know, people who are about my age, sometimes they always want to do something crazy. That's just kind of their temperament. Well, it wouldn't be good for an elder to have that kind of temperament, maybe where he always wants to push the envelope and see if he can do something wild and crazy. That wouldn't be healthy. Okay. It always contains the idea of control of the body and its movements and impulses. Is he able to control his desires in various ways? That's very important. So here are some questions to ask to try to decide if an elder is of good behavior. And one question we should ask is, does he either accidentally or purposefully stir up problems in the church? There are some people who are always causing problems in the church, and sometimes they may not even mean to, but they don't have good discretion with the words that they say. And so they sometimes will say things that really hurt people's feelings, and it's needless. There's no need for that, but they just have a tendency to say things that are out of order, and it really can cause problems. And so here are some verses about peace in the church, that we're to be peacemakers and that we're to be at peace among ourselves. And peace in the church is just not real consistent with some people's character. And so before we appoint an elder, we need to ask ourselves, is he the kind of person who is either accidentally or on purpose causing problems? Questions or comments about that? Have you ever known someone like that? Who is just kind of, you might think of them as having a mouth that is a loose cannon. They're just going to say things that are not in order, going to hurt people's feelings for no good reason. Now, sometimes we can't avoid hurting people's feelings. I'm confident that good preachers hurt people's feelings sometimes, and good elders hurt people's feelings. But you only do that by telling the truth in love in a way that's not designed to hurt anybody's feelings. And sometimes it can't be helped, right? But in general, you want to use good, healthy, peaceful words and not intentionally try to hurt people. Questions or comments about that? Y'all are so quiet. Okay. Think about things to say. Jump in there. Jump in there. Okay. When he stands up for what he believes, is he rude or coarse? Elders have to stand up for what they believe, don't they? But how are we to do that? With meekness or gentleness and fear, godly fear. That is recognizing God's authority. And recognizing our need to be humble before others. There are two ways you could stand up for the truth. One is to stand up for the truth in love, Ephesians 4:15. But another way would be to stand up for the truth in a way that hurts people and looks down upon people. I've heard preachers before where I thought that their tone was just kind of harsh and arrogant instead of being loving. Can you speak the truth, that even truth that's hard to hear? What about a sermon on hell that is spoken in a loving way? Is that possible? Is it possible to have a sermon that would even cause people to think that they were going to go to hell if they didn't change? And yet is in a loving way? Could that be done? Could an elder speak a word like that to someone? Elders got to be able to do that. Because what's an elder doing with unfaithful members? He's going to them and pleading with them to be faithful. He's pleading with them to repent if they're living in sin, to try to urge them to do what's right. But what if he does it in a mean way? What if he does it coarsely? He's not obeying 1 Peter 3:15, and he's just not of good behavior if he does it that way. What about his language? What about what's going to happen if an elder uses coarse language? Is that going to be a good influence for the church? What if he uses gutter talk? Is that of good behavior? Does that fit with our image of what an elder ought to be from these passages? I think of good behavior would rule out a man like that. Now, it may be that we could talk to him and get him to clean up his mouth a little bit, But he's not going to be a good influence for the church, is he? He's not of good behavior. Okay, do his neighbors and business associates recognize him as being mannerly, courteous, and disciplined? Now, this doesn't mean that he can't have a good time or that he can't joke around with people, but he needs to be the kind of a person where if somebody were to ask, is he courteous to others, that the answer would be an unhesitating, yes, he's always courteous to people. Does he have good manners? Is he disciplined? How about 1 Timothy 3:7 is one of the other qualifications that says he must be well thought of by outsiders. Well, one of the quickest ways to get poorly thought of by outsiders is to not be nice to them, to be rude to them, or to look down on them or say unkind things to them. And how about being the aroma of Christ among the world, the people who are perishing? He ought to be exemplary in terms of his Christian influence toward others in the world. Questions or comments about that? Is that a good question to ask? I think it probably would be. How about this question? Do his family members respect him? That's a big question. What if people seem to have a generally good view of him, but the people in his own family think he's not worth respecting, or they just can't stand to be around him, or they always have something negative to say about him? Well, that could be partially a problem with them, but it also might be a problem with him. That would be something we would really have to iron out. And plus, it might keep him from fulfilling the other qualifications, such as 1 Timothy 3:4 that we'll get to later, that says he's got to manage his own household well. If the people in his own family think that he's not a very good person, then it's going to be tough for him to fulfill that qualification. Okay, and how about husbands loving their wives as their own bodies? Is he a good Christian husband if his wife thinks that he isn't? Well, at least that would have to be investigated. Seems like it's going to be hard for him to meet the qualifications if that's the case, if she doesn't. What about fathers, don't provoke your children to anger? If his children are provoked to anger, if his children can't stand the sight of him, then this is going to be a problem. Questions or comments about that? This would be an indication that he's not of very good behavior if his family members don't like him. Does he respond well to stress, difficulty, and criticism? Is an elder going to be criticized sometimes? Is an elder going to be in stressful situations? Is an elder going to be having to deal with a lot of different issues all at once sometimes, stressful scenarios? Certainly. Some of you haven't been privileged to be in elders' meetings at times, but I have, and I can just tell you, there are a bunch of issues. There are a range of things that come up, and elders, just by nature of their job, have to make a lot of decisions. And you know that some people are pretty good folks, but when they get under stress, you see a different side to them. You see a side you don't want to see very often. And then they might, under stress, they might say hurtful things. Or when they're backed into a corner by someone who's critical of them, all of a sudden they strike out in anger. You know what I'm talking about? And then bad things can happen. Disaster can strike in the church if you have an elder who just turns into a different kind of person under stress, because stressful times will necessarily come because they're dealing with human beings. So he's got to be able to keep his cool under stress and maintain a level of good behavior even when there are hard times, even when there's a lot of different things coming at him. Questions or comments about that? One more question. Is he a show-off? You know, Jesus said, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. And some people are show-offs, and sometimes a person who's a little bit of arrogant and a show-off can get people to follow him because he might be very persuasive. And people might think, oh, there's a strong leader. But really, what he wants is to just get his way all the time and doesn't really want to be a shepherd. His concern is with his own prestige. His concern is with building a reputation for himself. And his concern is not really with trying to help people go to heaven. See, a shepherd, an elder, is really a servant fundamentally, and not somebody who is aggrandizing himself. And if his concern is to aggrandize himself, then he's not Christ-like, and he doesn't need to be leading the people of God to begin with. How would we know if somebody was that way or not? I don't know that there's a right answer to this, but and on any of these, do you want to raise some particular issues where you think, you know, here's how we would know if a person is of good behavior or not? I've tried to raise a few, and you may want to give us some more insight into that to say this would be a red flag. What would be a red flag on this or other issues like that? Good. Okay. Russell said two good things here. One is, if you watch somebody who just really enjoys the spotlight, that would raise a red flag. Somebody who just really enjoys having all the focus on him, all the attention on him, and likes to draw away followers after him. If it seems like his concern is with how many people I can get on my side of everything, as opposed to lets everybody be on the Lord's side, well, then that's a problem. And then the other thing Russell said is, that's exactly the trap that denominational thinking has gone into, which is that really in the local congregation, we follow the pastor or the priest or the bishop or the person who's in charge. And I've talked to denominational people and read from them before, as we did last quarter in our, or some quarter in the past when we did our denominational doctrines class. We saw people who said very explicit things about how we follow the pastor, or I just let my bishop or my priest tell me what to think. Now, what if you had an elder in the church who loved that? He just loved it when people said, I'm just going to do whatever the elder says, no matter what. I have no concern about what the Bible says. I'm a follower of this guy. Hold on a minute. What about 1 Corinthians 1? Remember in 1 Corinthians 1, the Apostle Paul said, some people in the church are saying, I'm of Apollos or I'm of Cephas. And he said, in 1 Corinthians 3, he said, who is Paul? Who is Apollos? We're just the ministers through whom you believe. Now here's an apostle saying, wait a minute, don't be saying you're a follower of Paul. He says, follow me in 1 Corinthians 11, 1. He says, follow me only insofar as I follow Christ. So you can follow my example of Christ-like living, but all of this is for following Christ, not for following me. But there have been elders in the church. I'm not talking about Macklin Road. I'm just saying the church has known elders before that said, I'm kind of the king, and you got to follow me. Haven't churches split at times in the past because there might be one or two elders that say, people need to be on our side of everything. And that was their goal instead of everybody being on the Lord's side. Very good. What else? Maybe not about this one, but about any of the ones we've looked at. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Sometimes the people that aren't as obvious make wonderful elders because they do have the patience. They do have the knowledge and the capability.
That's right.
They are humble individuals, right?
So they may not be the kind of a person who would be in the limelight as much as somebody else because they're not seeking it.
Right. So
yes. That's right. That's right. I hope y'all could hear most of that. I can't say it in the words that are as good as Jeff just used, but the summary of that is we shouldn't be examining who could be an elder based on a popularity contest. There are two extremes about that. One extreme is to say, I want the person to be an elder who is the most popular. That's extreme. Somebody, as we said, may not be in the limelight very much, may not be as well known as somebody who's better qualified. On the other hand, you wouldn't want to go so far as to say if somebody is popular, he can't be an elder. Because it may very well be that a good shepherd is well known and people enjoy being with him. And so it may be that I think a big difference comes down to his personality. You know, some people are just naturally more verbal and more gregarious than others. But you know, that's not a qualification for being an elder. Being verbal and gregarious is not necessary. But some people are that way, and that doesn't disqualify them from being an elder. Is that fair? That makes sense? Okay, what else? Red flags on this issue of good behavior. What might you observe in someone and you might say, I'm worried about appointing him because he's not of good behavior? What else? One would be that he's just arrogant and wants everybody to look at him all the time. What else? Because that might be an indication that he's going to do what 1 Peter 5 warns against, which is lording it over the flock. Somebody like that's going to lord over. He's going to say, my opinion rules, and not be concerned about souls and about applying what the Bible says. It's going to be applying my agenda. See. What else? Oh, yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I'm very forgetful. You know that already, but go ahead. Right. Yeah. So there are some people, the comment is, there are some people who think that they're on a different level from everybody else, and that would show itself in, I don't have to talk to that person. You know, here's a person that I just think I'm inherently better than, so I don't have to worry about helping that person go to heaven, because that's just so-and-so. But what did Jesus say in Matthew 25? He said, inasmuch as you have done it to who? To the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So elders are servants of just some people in the congregation or all the people. They're servants of all the people, not just the ones that they might think are on their same artificial level, whatever that level may be. Very good point. Okay, what else? Now let's move to the given to hospitality, if you're ready, and we can go on back, if you want to, if we have time, to this of good behavior. Let's talk about hospitality now. And the Greek word translated given to hospitality is a compound word from two, and it's a very neat word. It means friendly and strangers. So the idea is you're friendly to strangers. And it means, it's translated, seek to show hospitality. That word hospitality in Romans 12:13 is the same word that's used for hospitality in 1 Timothy 3. And then it says, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. And that's that very idea in Hebrews 13. And what's the reason given in Hebrews 13? Don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers because some have entertained angels unawares, and likely that's a reference to Abraham, but it also could be a reference to Samson's father, but at any rate, some have. Now, incidentally, before we leave that point about Hebrews 13, that passage we quoted just a minute ago from Matthew 25, about verse 38, where Jesus says, inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. This principle about giving hospitality to strangers could very well be, and the Hebrews writer says, some have entertained angels. What about entertaining the Lord? The Lord says, if you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So when we're doing our hospitality, we ought to be seeing the face of Jesus in the people to whom we are being hospitable. Okay. Now, here's another verse, 1 Peter 4. This is a key verse on hospitality. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Okay, think about the gifts you've received in your life. There are many, I'm sure. But what is your duty with all of the blessings you've been given. To be a good steward, of course. And what does a good steward do? He uses his blessings as God would have him use them. And that includes being hospitable with them. Do you have a house? Do you have a house that has space for someone to stay in it? Sometimes are you using that in a hospitable way? I've known so many Christians who are very hospitable, but I've also known some Christians who weren't very hospitable. What about the car that you drive? Are you using that in service to God? Taking yourself to Bible study and sometimes taking somebody else with you, helping somebody, giving him a ride when he needs a ride. Somebody helped me with a ride this week. It was sort of an accidental thing, but Rick and I were running an errand, and I didn't even realize that Rick wasn't planning on coming back to the church building. So Rick had to bring me all the way yonder across town, and I appreciated that a whole lot, but I felt kind of dumb at the same time. But I just didn't know what was going on. But Rick is very kind about it. Rick is a good steward, and I don't think he's in here, so I can say this about him. Rick's a good steward, you know, with the blessings that he's been given because he wants to use them to help other people. And so we all ought to have that attitude. And an elder is hospitable in the sense that he wants to use all his resources to be glorifying God. And that includes using them to serve other people. I'm thinking of an elder in another state right now who is very, very wealthy. And yet, I believe he is a great steward of the blessings that he's been given. For one thing, there will be a need that comes up in the church and they don't know how they're going to meet it from the church budget. And then all of a sudden, the money just kind of appears. And it's because of this particular elder. And also, he's very open with his home. People, travelers who are coming to preachers, you know, staying in his home. He's helping various works in the brotherhood with his money. And he is systematically trying to use his wealth, which he sort of came into accidentally. I could tell you the story sometime, and he worked hard for his money, but it's the fact that he got so wealthy from it is just kind of the luck of how capitalism works sometimes. You know, sometimes there's a need for a product and it just, there's a boom right there. Well, he sort of fell into it that way, and he's using that for the Lord, and we all must be that way. Okay. Now, motivations for hospitality. First of all, stewardship, as we mentioned from 1 Peter 4 a minute ago, stewardship demands it. So if you're going to be a good steward, you've got to be hospitable. Next, the golden rule demands it. Has anybody ever been hospitable to you and you needed that and you were grateful for that? Well, then let's pass that along to somebody else. If you like for people to be hospitable to you, then we must be hospitable to them, right? How about hospitable people will be blessed? What does Matthew 10:42 say? Whoever gives what? A cup of cold water to one of my brethren because he's a disciple, then he will in no means lose his reward. So here's a picture of hospitality, and it receives a blessing. So if you want to be blessed of God, then use what you have in a hospitable way. Here's a verse to consider. Then the righteous will answer him saying, oh, this is the verse we already quoted, but this is a verse about hospitality, isn't it? So the of good behavior thing and the hospitality verses can be, hospitality principles can be supported by the same scriptures. Notice this one. This is where Paul is traveling to Rome, and I hadn't really thought about this passage in terms of hospitality before, but Paul is welcomed into somebody's house, and the guy who expresses hospitality gets a blessing he did not anticipate. Here's how hospitality can bless the person who's hospitable. Now, in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island, Miletus, the island of Miletus, named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. And Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. What's going on here? Somebody's hospitable to a person who's teaching the gospel, and it brings a great blessing. And I can tell you from my experience, when we had preachers to stay in our house when I was growing up, sometimes the need for staying in somebody's house these days is not as great as it is today with the convenience of hotels and so forth. But when I was a kid, and a preacher would stay in our house, I learned things. And I was at his feet, and he was teaching me things. If I was small enough, he was probably wrestling with me. And this was a great experience. And so helping preachers, helping Bible teachers, helping elders when they need help. This is a great opportunity for learning ourselves and for getting a blessing. Continuing the reading there, and when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. That seems to be connected to the blessing that Publius's house received. Because Paul got hospitality there, he hung around there and people were healed. And then they also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. Okay, so put the passages that we've just seen together. One from Matthew 25, where Jesus says, "Inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me." And then the passage from Acts 28 about Paul and Publius' house, and what do you get? You get God telling us that hospitality gets a blessing. When people are opening their homes and their hearts to people, then God will take care of them. What about, for example, Elijah in the case of the lady who was running out of flour in 1 Kings 17? Here she received a great blessing because she did what for Elijah? She made him a little cake first. And she was hospitable, and then God took care of her. Do we think then that God will not take care of us if we're hospitable? How dare we think the opposite of that? The pattern in the Bible is God takes care of hospitable people. Another motivation. Hospitality is a bridge to evangelism and promoting the kingdom. Here's Romans 16:23. Gaius, who is host to me and to the whole church, greets you. When Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, evidently he was staying with a guy named Gaius, and Gaius had the whole church meeting in his house. Do you think Gaius accomplished something good by being hospitable to the Apostle Paul? Is it possible that we even have the letter to the Romans partially because of Gaius? Because Paul, while he was staying at Gaius's house, was able to get that thing done. I mean, that's very possible. I'm not being dogmatic about that, but I'm just saying here's a very important instance of hospitality. What about Philemon 22? At the same time, Paul says to Philemon, "Prepare a guest room for me, for I am hoping that through your prayers I will be graciously given to you." Wouldn't it be great to have the Apostle Paul stay at your house? And you say, sure, sure. And then I ask further the question from Matthew 25, wouldn't it be great to have Jesus stay at your house? And you say, sure. And then remember what Jesus said. Inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So here's motivation, I hope, for hospitality. Now, I've just put a picture of this on the board of people around the table. And I just wanted to observe that when we eat together, this is one of those great opportunities for lots of spiritual growth to occur. And I think that's part of the reason God made it so that we need to eat about three times a day, or four or five if you're like me. But you need to eat about three times a day is so we have this kind of automatic pause to sit down and potentially sit down with other people and communicate. I think with some families and with some churches, if we didn't have the meal time that we got together, we'd hardly say a word to each other. But God set it up so that we just have an automatic need to pause and eat. And we usually do that and have some conversation with somebody in most cases. And what about having that in our homes more often than we do? Elders need to be the kinds of people who have people in their homes. Thinking about this a little bit, what if an elder said to his wife, and here's where wives are very critical, elders' wives, why do elders need to be married? Well, one thing is hospitality is facilitated a lot better when there's a wife. But what if an elder said to his wife, honey, we had some visitors at service, and I'd like to have them over to have supper. They visited two or three times. Let's have them over for supper Friday night. And what if her response is, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to have people over at our house. Think of all the trouble that would be. We can't do that. Well, is it going to be easier or harder for him to do his work as a shepherd with an environment like that? It's going to be harder because this is less likely to happen. But getting around a table, if we can, and it doesn't have to be perfect. We'll talk for a minute about why we're not more hospitable, but can you think of why it is real important for an elder to be able to extend hospitality to people? I hope we're getting the idea that when we are able to be in our homes with people, when we're able to have private moments with people, that's when we can really be shepherds, isn't it? You can't really effectively be a shepherd at one time of 300 people. I don't understand how an elder could possibly hope to be a shepherd if his only interaction with the sheep was with 300 at once. Can you imagine a literal shepherd with his sheep trying to help all 300 of them at one time? He couldn't do that. But if he attends to one here and then he attends to one over here, then he can really help them and make sure they're all right. And so that's the same way in the church. Personalized attention. Isn't that the way it is in the education system? That parents are seeking after a low student-teacher ratio? Now apply that to the church. Elders are to be the feeding the flock, giving them the information they need. What if in a scenario the student-teacher ratio, if an elder's feeding the flock, if the student-teacher ratio is 300 to 1, well, some teaching can happen that way. I try to do it on Sunday mornings when we have about two, well, how many we have on Sunday mornings? 450, 500, something like that? That's not effective in terms of shepherding. I hope that I can tell what the Bible says and we can certainly grow thereby, but in terms of really dealing with people's problems, a one-on-one or a one-on-three or four is much more effective in that. And when does that happen? Usually it's something like around the dinner table, or it's around a small table, or it's in the living room. And that's why I very well often compare boardroom elders and living room elders. Which do we want? We want those living room elders. Now, elders need a room where they can make decisions. But very often in churches, what happens is elders start to think of themselves purely as decision makers and not so much as shepherds. Now, don't get me wrong. Elders have to make decisions, and they have authority to make those decisions. But the shepherding occurs in small, cozy little environments, like around the dinner table. And that's why hospitality is particularly urgent. Now, why aren't folks more hospitable, even in the church? Why aren't we more hospitable? One thing is our parents might not have ever gotten us in the habit of doing that. And if you've never been in the habit of it, it's kind of hard to start. We just got to make ourselves go ahead and do it if we're not in the habit. Another thing is our parents might have been crabby anytime company was coming. Maybe your mom was just somebody who said, well, company's coming, and all day it was just grouch, grouch, grouch because company was coming. And so you got the idea of, adults don't like company, so when I get to be an adult, I'm just going to fix that problem. I ain't going to have no company because that's bad for adults. Whatever parents convince their kids is bad, they'll probably grow up thinking it's bad. And if parents have convinced their kids that company's bad, then they'll just avoid it when they get older. And here's where parents need to make sure, if you want your son to grow up to be an elder, don't make him think that company is a disaster. Because he can't fulfill the qualification. He won't be hospitable. So it's got to be the other way around, where you're looking forward to the company coming. Everybody's getting involved in preparing for it. Maybe your son is helping to set the table or get the drinks together. Or maybe he's vacuuming or maybe whatever to help get ready for that. Maybe he's chopping the wood to build the fire. I don't know. But your son is getting involved in being excited and helping with the company coming. How about our culture applauds the workaholic? That may be a reason why we're not very hospitable anymore. What does the culture applaud? Somebody who works 60, 70 hours a week? Is it really feasible to do a lot of hospitality if you're at the office 60, 70 hours a week? Well, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard, especially in a scenario where the husband works 70 hours a week and the wife works 45. It's going to be very difficult to fulfill this obligation. Some sacrifices might have to be made. Maybe the meal doesn't have to be perfect, by the way. We can be busy and be hospitable, but it's going to be a lot harder. It's going to be a lot harder if we're always out of the house. And that's one of the reasons why I think Titus 2:5 says that the wives are to be what? Godly wives are keepers at home. And that literally means, the word literally means a stay at home. Now, we're not teaching that it's always wrong for a woman to have a job outside the home, but what we are saying is her primary obligation is to the home. And if an elder has a wife like that, and he has a job that keeps him out of the house 40 hours a week, he can still fulfill that obligation to be hospitable. Because he can help his wife, he can lead his wife in being hospitable, but she's keeping that home. And so even though he's outside of the home working a lot, he can still fulfill that command because she's fulfilling her obligation to be a keeper at home, Titus 2:5. Okay? Now then, we think the house must be perfect. That may be why we're not very hospitable. Because we think, oh, there's some dust on the mantle, so nobody can come over. For one thing, I've been in a lot of situations where somebody has me over for something and they say, I'm so sorry the house is like this. And it looks better than my house. You know, it doesn't look bad to me. And I think, well, what do they have to be ashamed of? It looks great. And so don't worry about it if it's not perfect. What's more important, having a Bible study with someone if the house is a little bit imperfect, or waiting and trying to get the house absolutely perfect but going 2 or 3 more months before we have that person over for the Bible study? What should we do? Go ahead and have the person over for the Bible study. And think about helping our kids to understand that when they help us get ready for company, they're helping us get ready to try to save a soul. What if little Johnny understands that when he's running to the market to get the bread or whatever, that we're hoping this whole thing will end up in a Bible study? We might not be able to get that far, but we're going to try. The whole goal of having these people over is not just to laugh and have a good time, but we're trying to convert these people. See, that gives little Johnny this idea that it's important to try to convert people, but then also little things help to convert people. Facilitating the meal. I remember many times when I was growing up that Mom would be telling me, go clean up your room or something. And I did that because I wanted to obey my mom. But when Mom would tell me, we've got company coming over and we're going to try to baptize them either tonight or maybe next week, well, then I thought, I really better clean my room because I want these people to obey the gospel. And I sort of had the idea that my cleaning my room for the company had something to do with that. And that got me, it may not have, but it got me real excited about trying to help evangelize these people. What could I do? Could I sit down and study the Bible with them as a 7, 8-year-old kid? No, I couldn't do that, but I could try to help set it up so sometimes when I was 12, 13 years old, I'd be watching the kids of the visitors who were there for the Bible study. And Mom would say, Caleb, if you'll watch these kids, I might be able to talk to her about her soul. And I thought, great, I'll watch the kids. Go ahead and study. And then I would kind of peek in there, or I would listen in and hear what Mom was saying to the person, and they'd be talking about Acts 2. Or they'd be talking about Cornelius, and I would think, okay, they're doing it. They're getting it done. And so I'd keep watching the kids. We'd put on another Lion King video or something, or we would, play with some other toy, and I'd be thinking, okay, I have something to contribute to this, even if I'm too young to really do the whole thing. Or maybe we think others ought to initiate. Maybe the reason we're not very hospitable is we've always thought that somebody else should take the first step. Well, they haven't had me over yet, so I don't have to have them over yet. Where do we ever read that in the Bible? That's not a biblical concept. Go ahead and try to have them over first. Okay, comments or questions about this? I think we're about out of our slides and we're about out of time. We have about 30 seconds or so left. Does anybody want to add anything about any of this? These two qualifications of good behavior, he's got to be of good behavior, and he's got to be hospitable. What would you add to any of that? That's right. Good. That's right. That's right. This is a good point. Maybe we think that hospitality is a bigger deal than it necessarily need be. Sometimes we have people over for a meal, but sometimes we just try to squeeze in something else where we meet them somewhere and have a Coke with them, meet them somewhere for dessert or something like that, or we just do something, just whatever we can do. It doesn't have to be every time we're hospitable. It doesn't have to be a major operation, does it? It can be a little thing. That's right. Good point. If there's kids involved, we have a lot of good parks. Aren't there many conversations about souls that occur while parents are watching their kids at the park? Think about that. Very good. Just get together and do something, but the key is that the roadblock for many of us is time. And so we've got to be willing to make the time to do whatever opportunities we have there. What else? Mr. George has something. Age has a lot to do with it too. Well, so sometimes age limits us, but we always have things we can do. And it may not be the same set of things that we could do when we were younger, but there are things we can do now that we couldn't do then. So, very good. Well, we shouldn't use it as an excuse to say, we don't use it. It's funny, sometimes we use age as an excuse with serving the Lord, but we wouldn't about other things like sports. When it comes to sports, we might say, I'm going to push myself as hard as I can and show them I can still do it. And then when it comes to serving the Lord, we say, oh, I think I'm too old for that. I can't do that anymore. See, we kind of reverse the attitude there. We shouldn't do that. But very good. That's a good comment. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you very much.